Now we turn to this past weekend's primary election action. The Democrats held their primary in South Carolina on Saturday, a week after Republicans had their contest in that state.
The African-American vote in South Carolina was projected to be a key factor, and Hillary Clinton carried that demographic decisively and with even more support than Barack Obama got in 2008.
Joining us now to discuss the role of African-American voters in this year's presidential contest is Cheryl Laird. She's an assistant professor of political science and African-American studies at St. Louis University. Cheryl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, how are you?
Well, good. So a lot of people have been watching for South Carolina and saying New Hampshire and Iowa, as primaries go, maybe not as representative of the diversity of the country as they could be. South Carolina was our first indication of how African-American voters might approach this Democratic presidential primary. What did you make of what you saw this weekend?
You know, I think this is consistent with how we should be expecting, or at least thinking about how African-Americans are seeing this electoral contest. I think we had a lot of African-American women who participated in this South Carolina primary. Additionally, a lot of older black women, so this is women over like 30, over 40 who participated, and that these individuals are not only consistent voters, they're very loyal voters, and then very many of them are seeing the Hillary campaign as being one that is reflective of the issues and concerns that they have. And I think Hillary and her campaign, Hillary Clinton's campaign, has done a very good job of really making appeals that are to the interest of those women, much better than I would think that Sanders has done, even though he's had endorsements from various individuals. I think there's definitely a generation difference there that you can see in his support, particularly with the African-American community. And part of that is coming from a long history, I think, of thinking about where the Democratic Party has sat with black voters, and particularly even where the Clintons have been sitting with black voters for at least the last, 20 years.
Let's talk. You mentioned endorsements. Let's look at that. There's been a battle in a way to get African-American endorsements from leading political figures, cultural figures as well. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton got the Congressional Black Caucus endorsement. Figures like Spike Lee came forward in the race to endorse Bernie Sanders. How important are endorsements this weekend in South Carolina and looking forward?
Endorsements are pretty key, and particular demographics within the black community are going to be interested in certain individuals or certain organizations or interest groups backing particular candidates. So I think the CBC in particular is going to be something that's going to be important for a lot of African Americans who have participated a lot within the electoral process, right? So those who have voted very frequently, who have knowledge of a lot of the people who are in office within the CBC, John Lewis particularly being somebody who stands out, right, as someone that is very well known within the African-American community, and particularly amongst the mid to older demographics amongst blacks. I think with Bernie Sanders, you have a whole kind of different set of individuals with Spike Lee, as well as like Killer Mike, who's a rapper, Eric Garner's daughter, right, appealing much more to a younger demographic. But in terms of primary turnout, when we're thinking about Democratic partisans and the people who are going to turn out at high rates, I mean, you really have this solid group of black women who really are consistent in their turnout and have really been shaping this primary season. I think we'll continue to see that.
Talking about turnout, I have seen over the last 8 years or so a notion out there that, okay, Barack Obama running, historical moment, first black president, that generated a lot of excitement, higher African-American voter turnout. That's going to fizzle. We won't see that kind of turnout again in, say, 2016. What do you think about that notion?
We actually will see some turnout. It may not be as high because of the historical moment of appointing an African-American or electing an African-American president, but I think Hillary being that Hillary Clinton as a woman, and that much of the people who are going to be voting for the African-American community are going to be women in the majority on that, are seeing this as a historical moment. And even recently, the New York Times had a really good piece from Nicole Hannah-Jones that was talking about the ways in which many black women were seeing the Hillary campaign and her run as an opportunity to not only be able to say, I was supporting her back in 2008, but then Obama came on with this historic moment and was able to get this momentum coming out of Iowa and through into the primary season, and then South Carolina, him winning that by a substantial margin. and that this is now an opportunity to get some gender equity in terms of representation as well, that they would like to see a woman in the White House, and that this is an important historical moment as well. So I think that we could definitely see some turnout. We may not see as much youth turnout, possibly. I think that would be very interesting to kind of think about, especially with African-American youth. They may not be as energized and excited about Hillary. And I think some of that is even stemming from the fact that many of them were some of them are even born at the time when she was in office in terms of being first lady. And so they don't really have a living memory of the Clinton administration and what that was meaning for blacks at that time. So that also is kind of a historical context that's important for thinking about this as well.
Bernie Sanders has done well with younger voters in general, in some cases a lot better with younger voters. Do you think that he could excite younger African-American voters in a way that maybe Hillary Clinton isn't?
And partly because I think his policies are seen as a bit more progressive than hers. And again, that historical memory of the Clintons is just not there as much for younger voters, right? So they did not live through that experience as much. Some of them were coming of age at that time. And so I think he can make some appeals with his policies that he is definitely more left-leaning, and that age group, that terms of crystallized political positions, is going to be much more malleable than it is for individuals who are middle or older in terms of where their age is. And so that is going to be an important place for him to be able to appeal to. But I think he actually will probably do his best, and what we've seen, like in Iowa and some other places, that he's had really good appeal amongst actually like white male young voters, 18 to 30. So I think he could definitely win with black voters in that same age group, but he may not see as much energy in terms of the turnout like we probably would have seen with Obama.
We're talking to Cheryl Laird, assistant professor of political science and African-American studies at St. Louis University, looking at Saturday's Democratic primary in South Carolina and how black voters are viewing Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders as candidates. We'll pick up the conversation in just a few moments. We continue our conversation on the weekend South Carolina primary with Cheryl Laird, assistant professor of political science and African-American studies at St. Louis University. We're looking at the influence of black voters in the Democratic primary and this November's general election. Cheryl, I want to move to the Republican side of things for just a moment. After the election of 2008, a lot of Republicans said, hey, we need to reach out, do better with non-white voters if we're going to have a chance of winning the presidency again. Fast forward to 2016, a lot of people are pointing to this incident with Donald Trump initially not denouncing an endorsement from David Duke. People bring up the Ku Klux Klan in relationship to support for Donald Trump. We've been hearing in the news, said he had had a bad earpiece, so that's why he didn't answer the David Duke question the way he meant to. But having these issues out there, is this something that you think might energize African-American voters against Republicans in general?
I think it potentially can. You know, this reminds me even when the voter ID issues were becoming really discussed heavily in like 2008 and 2012, and a lot of people thought that this would actually inhibit black voters from being able to voice their views. And in fact, what we found is that a lot of black voters were very motivated to go to the polls and would work around whatever policies were in place to make sure that their voices were being heard. And so I think it really isn't going to be favorable for the party. You know, there's research by Tasha Philpott at the University of Texas that talks about the party image of the Republican Party, and that there's basically an understanding amongst African Americans that with the Southern strategy and the history of the Republican Party, that over the years, even as various things have changed and different people have kind of come to the front as representatives that are more diverse for the party, underneath that, people still believe that substantively the party has not changed a lot of its platform in terms of its issues on race, civil rights, justice, and social justice issues. And so I think this is not helping, particularly that David Duke not being denounced for the history and knowledge and awareness of what people have of that, particularly the demographic of blacks, basically middle-aged to older blacks that are most likely to be as active in the political process for this election, being individuals who can remember when David Duke was being discussed previously and knows the history of who he is. And so I think it'll have a significant impact and, in fact, could very well serve as a driving force for people to really get motivated to come out and vote.
You know, more generally, I think in the media, we can sometimes use shorthand phrases like, you know, Latino vote, women vote, veterans vote, and the black vote, when there's actually a lot more variety and subtlety within a category. So is the black vote, the African-American vote, really this monolithic thing, or is there a lot of detail that we miss when we talk that way?
I think there's, you know, a lot of nuance to how people are coming to assessment, or at least coming to their decisions on their political actions, right? At least in the research that I have done, you know, we look into the significance of thinking about communities and social surroundings and social networks amongst African Americans, and how much does homogeneity, or at least the same types of people of the same racial group, being in the communities that you're in when you're going through your political socialization, affect your worldview, affect the way that you're going to be seeing the world and even seeing the political space. And so I think there's a lot of nuance there in the understandings of what things people are taking into consideration there. And so there's some generational differences, there's some experiential differences, right? So there's a lot of Black veterans, right? And so that intersectional identity, I think, serves an important thinking about how people are seeing not only like military identity as well as their racial identity, and how much that is kind of shaping how they see the political world and political space. And so it's not as monolithic as I think people often want to say it is. I think there are definitely understood norms, and part of that is because it is a two-party system in a lot of ways, right? Like, we kind of fall back into the two parties, even when third parties or even four parties emerge, we fall back into this two-party system. And so in many ways, you know, a lot of the interests that are being defined or being understood by Blacks just really aren't getting picked up or being shown to be actually prioritized, particularly by the Republican Party. And so oftentimes that party does not seem to really garner a lot of support from African Americans.
Let's look ahead to, well, tomorrow. It's Super Tuesday. A lot of states in the southern United States voting for the Democratic Party. That means African American voters, again, like South Carolina, being big players in that race. Do you see similar things likely to happen as happened this weekend in South Carolina?
I mean, any place where you're going to see a large portion of the Democratic electorate being African-American is going to be a place where we're probably going to see Hillary really get a lot of support. So I think Alabama is going to be one to think about. Georgia is going to be another. Virginia is going to be another, right? These are all places that have decent enough sizes, or even sizes almost similar to South Carolina, of Blacks who are there. And many places, even like Georgia, for instance, she has endorsements from John Lewis and the CDC going in on that. So I think that'll be very helpful for her as well. She's going into Arkansas, which, you know, she was former first lady for the governorship there. And so she's in a space where I think African Americans will definitely probably be very strongly behind her. And again, in the primaries, it's going to be your strong partisans that are coming out. And for African Americans, your strong partisans are definitely going to be older African American in terms of who's going to be consistent, as well as Black women. And those individuals are showing that they definitely have leanings towards the Clinton campaign over Sanders.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We've been talking to Cheryl Laird. She's assistant professor of political science and African American studies at St. Louis University. She shared her thoughts on Black voters and the ongoing presidential race.
Election 2016 is off to a bumpy start. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright ended up apologizing after referencing an old line, "There's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women." That she said in support of Hillary Clinton.
On the Republican side, the mudslinging and name-calling just intensified, with Marco Rubio going after Donald Trump, who's had no qualms about going after anyone since day one. Here's a bit of the most recent GOP debate featuring Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and Donald Trump.
Donald claims to care about
him. But he sent me his book with his autograph.
Donald, I understand rules are very hard for you.
You're doing a great job. I have his book.
Okay,
Thank you for the book.
That is the debate. And then we have more recent comments made by Marco Rubio addressing again Donald Trump.
But he's flying around on Air Force One and tweeting. So here's the one tweet he put out. He put out a picture of me having makeup put on me at the debate, which is amazing to me that a guy with the worst spray tan in America is attacking me for putting on makeup.
Well, our guest today says this year's campaigns are the dirtiest in decades. Joseph Cummins joins us now. He's the author of Anything for a Vote: Dirty Tricks, Cheap Shots, and October Surprises in U.S. Presidential Elections. Joseph, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. I mean, you know, I have to say that you stopped that quote before Marco, which Marco Rubio made last night at Roanoke College, before he went on to talk about how small Donald Trump's hands were. which I think is probably the first small penis joke that I may have heard presidential candidates make about each other. And I've done a lot of studying of presidential campaigns.
Well, some interesting territory that the election is getting into this year. That's for sure, I guess, putting it mildly. So in the pantheon of dirty campaigns, and how dirty is election 2016 so far?
You know, I have a sleaze meter that I use to rate American presidential election campaigns, and I have to say this one is already a 10. In fact, it's ratcheting off the dial and may have to go a bit higher. I think probably this primary season, speaking now specifically of the primary season, is the dirtiest primary season since 1922 in what would end up between the Nixon McGovern race. Especially in Iowa and New Hampshire, with Ted Cruz's people playing some really old-fashioned bare-knuckle dirty tricks, you know, sending false mailers to the people in Iowa, telling them that they would end up having their voting scores, quote-unquote, revealed to their neighbors, and claiming that Ben Carson had dropped out of the race. I mean, that's really classic stuff.
And I guess when we're talking about dirty campaigns, we're not just talking about, you know, insults like we just heard, mudslinging. We're talking about some sort of shady tactics, too, right?
We are, yeah. Although, and that's what the Ben Carson thing is, I think. These days, so far anyway, the main shady tactics have, and they're not really even that shady, have been the massive amounts of money being spent on commercials to trash the other candidate. If you're going back further in history in a number of different ways, there have been some really dirty, dirty elections. 1964 was one where you have Lyndon Johnson running against Barry Goldwater. It's one of the dirtiest elections that actually the American public did not know about.
What happened?
For some time. Yeah, where he formed a group of people to specifically go after Barry Goldwater, and even ended up sending E. Howard Hunt into Goldwater's campaign to pose as an aide and to steal Goldwater's position papers. So, and that's the kind of dirty, shady tactics that, you know, are pretty popular in American history. So
by that metric, maybe this race isn't so bad. It seems as though primarily what we're looking at here is a lot of insults.
Well, it's unusual, though, and it's unusual for a couple of reasons. I mean, the clip that you had of Marco Rubio talking, and then, of course, Donald Trump standing there on the debate stage yelling liar at Ted Cruz and choke artist at Rubio. You haven't actually seen this type of spectacle for some time, and I'm calling the election of, you know, 2016 a spectacle election, and it's part carnival, part Circus Maximus. So it isn't quite dirty, you know, in that sense, but you really have to go all the way back to 1912 and the personality of Teddy Roosevelt, who basically disrupted and nearly destroyed the Republican Party at that time, to find an election that was anywhere close to this in terms of the way candidates comported themselves.
Well, so you've been tracking this over the years. You've been tracking it right now. What evidence is there about what kind of effect this has on the electorate to witness a race like this?
I think, normally speaking, and you know, there are some pretty dirty elections. 64 was one, 72 was another. 1988, George H.W. Bush and Dukakis was yet another. I think this one will have an effect on the electorate. And the reason I believe that is because I do think, even in this day and age, we like to think that our candidates are going to have at least a modicum of dignity on stage. I mean, what these guys are doing, I think, is, as almost anyone will attest, is very adolescent, very schoolyard stuff. And it has nothing whatsoever to do with the issues. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the things that are troubling America today. So, I mean, you know, call me a cockeyed optimist, but I like to think that people are going to get tired of that. But who knows? We'll see.
Well, we saw Donald Trump pretty much out of the gate being pretty aggressive toward his opponents. He had a sort of a Twitter war against Jeb Bush, who for a long time, Jeb Bush, along with everybody else, no one really wanted to respond in kind, and taking that the high road, which seems like it should appeal to a certain group of voters, that you're not engaging in the sort of insults that might be going around with other candidates. But it seems as though in this race, I don't know, does anyone really have the option of taking the high road?
Not anymore. I think Trump has proved that. I mean, when you call somebody, quote-unquote, low energy you know, that's a keg that stuck with Bush, and he never was able to shake that. And the high road often doesn't work against really determined dirty tricks. If you look at 2004 and the swift voting of John Kerry, John Kerry was taken a bit by surprise by that attack, as he was supposed to be the Democrats' great, you know, war hero hope. But in fact, he did not respond effectively to those attacks during several primetime weeks in the summer of 2004, and he attempted to take the high road, and it actually, I think, it helped lose him the election. However, I don't think what Rubio is doing now is going to work too well either, because he's getting down into the mud with Trump. So I think that's taking too low a road, if you will. So.
What about the Democrats? How is their race stacking up?
Well, they basically seem like scholars and intellectuals compared to what's going on with the Republicans, which I think is really redefining the Republican Party. I mean, at least when you have Sanders and Hillary debating each other, they're talking about the issues. I mean, it isn't that they're not, you know, fustigating and, you know, telling a few lies here and there, but they really come across as people who are issue-oriented and who are attempting to find some solutions to things.
Now, we tend to look back to our forefathers sometimes in times like this, the era of Jefferson, Washington,
yeah,
those days that were pure and untrammeled, or so we think. But it sounds like there really was never at that time,
yeah,
was there, when there was pure politics and everyone took the high road?
Oh, yeah. I always say that really the only clean election in American history was 1789, when Washington ran unopposed. So, you know, beginning in 1800, really, it was one of only the fourth election in American history, and it was one of the dirtiest, where in those days, candidates, of course, did not themselves come out and attack each other. They retained, they stayed back in private, but Jefferson hired people to call Adams a hideous hermaphrodite and a repulsive pedant, and Adams got his own people to call Jefferson a godless atheist and a supporter of the terror of the French Revolution. And it basically got worse from there. Many of the icons in American history were involved in these political attacks. Davy Crockett claimed that Martin Van Buren wore women's clothing. Poor James Buchanan had a bit of a birth defect that caused his neck to tilt slightly to the left. So his opponents claimed that he had attempted to hang himself and failed. And would you really want a president who couldn't even hang himself properly, et cetera, et cetera. Abraham Lincoln had smelly socks, you know, and onward. So really, the elections of 2016 right now remind me so much more of those elections, because in the 19th century, you had as many as 75% to 80% of the electorate turning out to vote. Those who could vote almost always did vote. And so it was a huge grand spectacle. And we're seeing this right now, even on the eve of Super Tuesday, where people who are voting early, there's a lot of people voting right now. A lot of people are interested in this. So I probably, one byproduct of some of the dirty tricks being played, or at least some of the sleazy campaigning, is that it does, frankly, get people interested.
So
get them out to vote.
It's gonna up the turnout?
Yeah, definitely. It already has.
Well, we'll keep watching it. Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure.
That was Joseph Cummins, author of Anything for a Vote, Dirty Tricks, Cheap Shots, and October Surprises in U.S. Presidential Elections. He wrote about this year's race for Politico, and you can read his piece on the Central Time Facebook page.